Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. Looking forward to a huge show tonight. This is going to be a fun one.
This is one we've been looking forward to, and it came together really fast. We just decided last week we would talk about Transcendent Man this week, and little did we know we would be in such great shape to do such a show, because we've got not only the director of the film on with us this evening, but we've also got a terrific panel of futurists, not least of which is the two of us, to talk about the movie. So I think we're going to have an awful lot of fun, and we should just jump right in and get started.
Absolutely. No time for small talk tonight.
Yeah, no time for our little anecdotes this evening. We're going to jump right in. First off, I'd like to bring out our panel. We've got two distinguished futurists with us this evening. The first one is a philosopher. She's an artist, and she is a noted transhumanist. Her name is Natasha Vita Moore. Welcome back to Fast Forward Radio. Natasha, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to tonight's talk.
Always great to have you with us. And, of course, our Hollywood correspondent, our official Hollywood correspondent is here with us this evening, PJ Manny. She is a writer. She's a transhumanist. She's a leader in the H-plus community. Always a pleasure to have you with us, PJ.
Great to be back, guys. I always love your show.
Thank you. All right, well, let me talk about our guest. I've got a little bit of an introduction for him. At age 12, Barry Ptolemy was first inspired to create films by Steven Spielberg on the set of E.T., The Extraterrestrial, where he worked and studied closely alongside the director for the duration of the production. After attending USC Film School, Barry went on to direct and produce dozens of award-winning commercials and films. In 2006, his interest in the sciences led him to read Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near, upon which his first feature, Transcendent Man, is based. He also recently directed the commercial We Are the World 25 for Haiti with Lionel Richie and Quincy Jones, which aired during the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympic opening ceremonies. Barry was recently hailed as one of the new power directors by Los Angeles Confidential magazine. Barry Ptolemy, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thanks for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you with us this evening, and we want to jump right in and talk a little bit about your film, Transcendent Man. I think we've all seen it, so we're going to get into it in some detail. But before we do that, we'd just like to ask you, how's it going with the movie? I know it's in kind of a limited release now. How is it being received, and what future is there for it in terms of maybe wider distribution?
Well, it's doing, appreciate that. It's being received quite well. For example, on iTunes, I mean, primarily our release is a digital release. And in so far as in the digital domain, it's doing quite well. For example, on iTunes, it's I think currently right now the number two documentary in the United States. I think number two, either number one or number two in Canada. So those are the two markets we're currently in. We're also on Movies on Demand, where the film is doing very well. We'll be on DVD in May, on May 24th, and we're starting to move over to the UK and Europe and opening markets abroad. But considering that we're just now coming into the second week of our release, I'm very pleased with how we're being received and how many people are talking about the film and going to watch it.
So can you tell us, most regular listeners of Fast Forward Radio, of course, are familiar with Ray Kurzweil and know what we mean when we talk about the singularity. But we've got some new listeners in Milton, Massachusetts this evening who I think would, and elsewhere, who would benefit from a quick rundown on what's the movie about, if you can give a quick synopsis of that.
Sure. Well, the film is biographical in nature. It's a film about the life and ideas of Ray Kurzweil. But it really focuses primarily on his concept of the singularity, that point in the near future when technology will be speeding up so much that we will have to merge with it if we want to keep pace with it. So it's really an introduction, if you will, to these ideas. It's not an advanced course. We're trying to introduce people for the very first time who have never even heard of the singularity, which is most people. So we're trying to give those people a kind of an introductory course and get them up to speed with what is the singularity, what it's all about, how will it, kind of change your life in the not too distant future. And then there's other. We also go into Ray's personal life. There's a father and son story that we get into that helps personalize what we're talking about as well. So that's kind of just a brief encapsulation of the film.
And just for those not familiar, a quick 30 seconds on what is the singularity? What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, it's a point in the near future. Ray puts the date at 2045. It could be in the late 30s, it could be in the early 40s, whatever. He puts it at 2045 for his own reasons. But it's a point when our technology base, like I said, is increasing exponentially, and it's getting to the point where it will be so great that if we don't literally merge with that technology, it will just far outstrip our ability to keep up in the native world. And so we'd be kind of left behind a la, a Terminator kind of scenario. Not that it would exist, like there's, I don't believe in the Terminator scenario, but we could, in theory, be left completely behind if we were not to merge with this technology. So that's kind of, I think Ray's technical definition of what the singularity is. There are other definitions as well.
Yeah, we deal with varying, kind of sometimes conflicting, competing, and overlapping definitions of the singularity all the time. But I think that I think that the emergence of a greater than human artificial intelligence is kind of at the heart of what the singularity is all about. So, what made you want to make this particular film? What is it about Ray Kurzweil and his ideas that captivated you that said, I've got to go make a feature film out of this?
Well, I just, being a filmmaker, I just simply saw the most profound, powerful story that I'd ever come across. I mean, it just stood out to me. The story goes, there was a book review by a professor I'd actually had sat in on his classes, a physics professor, Gregory Benford, who's also a brilliant novelist, and he had written this book review in L.A. Times some years ago, actually back in 2006, probably January. I'm going to say January 2006. And I saw this book review across the room, and almost like just like a gravitational force, I saw the word singularity actually from across the room, and I was like, "What is that?" And I walked over and I read it, and I didn't even get through finishing this book review, and I grabbed my wife and my producing partner Felicia, and I had to just get down to the bookstore and get this book. And went down there and picked up this tome of a 672-page book off the shelf and said, what the heck is this? And I kind of leafed through it, and I saw these graphs, and I was like, oh, my goodness, I really want to invest this much of myself in a book right now. And I put it back, believe it or not. I put the book back on the shelf, and Felicia said, no, listen, you got to get the book you came for. You were so inspired. You got to get the book. So got the book, got home, started reading the book. And I wasn't done with chapter two. I mean, I was immediately blown away, but I wasn't through chapter two when I just knew that this was and I had been looking for a project for a long time that I was going to really sink my teeth into. I knew by the end of chapter two that this was the book. This was the subject. This was the topic. I'm going to draw a line in the sand. I'm going to do everything I can and bring all the resources I can to bear to make a film about this, because I had never seen a work as profound as this, and I believe it's the most profound actually work in all of human history, but that's just my opinion. But nevertheless, I saw in it this universal story, this archetypal mythological story of a man revealing our destiny. And so I made a movie about it.
Well, I'm very glad you did, because you made an outstanding film. Now, just to clarify, because there might be some confusion on this point, there is a movie called The Singularity Is Near. So can you distinguish Transcendent Man from that movie?
Well, Transcendent Man is an independent film. It's made independently of Ray Kurzweil completely. And, in fact, while we're discussing this, I should point out that Ray had no creative control over Transcendent Man in any way, shape, or form. In fact, he did not watch one frame, 1 second of Transcendent Man until 3 weeks prior to the world premiere in 2009 at Tribeca, and at which point, by the way, it was too late to change anything. We were already completely in online. Everything was completely glued in. I mean, there was no way to change anything. So he had no creative control. Now, he, as you pointed out, he has directed and produced another film based on his own work called The Singularity Is Near. So our deal wasn't completely exclusive. We had the ability to I was able to adapt his book, and the book inspired me to make Transcendent Man, but I didn't have the total exclusive rights to make it all by myself. He also was making a film. So he made his film, and I made a film. And if you're really into The Singularity, you can watch them both and probably get a pretty good snapshot of what we're talking about.
Well, having seen both, I can say that it's interesting to kind of juxtapose the two views of Ray Kurzweil. I guess Ray's view of himself, which in a sense you see in The Singularity Is Near, and an outsider's view of Ray, or someone else's view of Ray, that you get in Transcendent Man. Just in terms of, I think there is an introspective quality to Transcendent Man, a kind of a melancholy to the story that I didn't expect, having seen, knowing Ray and having seen The Singularity Is Near, that I didn't expect, that that took me by surprise, and that I found very, actually quite touching, quite moving, the detail about Ray and his feelings for his father. Not something I expected to see in a movie on this subject, and that really had an impact. I think that part of the movie really gets your attention and kind of gives you a feel for what it is that might drive someone to pursue something like this.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Ray was expecting it either, by the way. I mean, he was probably a little he was probably shocked the first time I really started to ask him questions about his father. He felt very, after a while, he grew comfortable with my questions, but I think he might have been a little surprised at my interest in his father up front. And when I asked him, I remember I'm actually here in D.C. now for a screening we have tomorrow, but it was at the steps of the Lincoln Monument back in 2007, I think May of 2007, where I asked, because we were filming there, I said, would you take us to your father's gravesite? And he kind of recoiled and he was a little shocked, but I think, if he were to be asked now about the experience, I think he considers it to be a very positive experience, and he has said that it is, I think, taught him something about himself and some things that he didn't know. So,
It's a terrific perspective, and I'll tell you what, we want to bring our panel in on the discussion. I don't want to completely capitalize on the time, so I'll open it up to PJ and Natasha. Either one of you, do you have a question for Barry?
Yes. Why are there so few women in the film?
That's an
excellent
question.
That's a great question.
Is that Natasha? Was that your question?
Yes. Yes. Why? I mean, there's an actress in it, but she's not a futurist. So I'm going to remove that lovely and talented woman out of the picture. But in the individuals who were in the film, which has a scope of science, technology, and science fiction, that's including Shatner, why are there no other women in this portrayed in this project?
Yeah, That's a great question, Natasha, and one I get all the time when I'm out screening the film. And when I'm actually live in front of an audience and my producing partner and my wife is there, I usually defer to her and ask her to answer the question for me. But since she's not here tonight, I'll have to answer it for myself. And suffice to say, there's a couple things going on here. One is in the field of sciences, unfortunately and sadly, there are not as many women as we'd like to have. And, I have a daughter myself, and we are very keen to get her interested in the sciences early and have that interest continue on. Because a lot of girls are very interested in math and sciences early on in junior high, and then somewhere
yes, but within this community of looking at the sciences and technologies of genetic engineering or artificial general intelligence, nanotechnology, futurology, there are women, including myself. I was surprised that I wasn't invited to be part of this project. Now, that being as it may, that's not a big deal, but there are other women of the background and scientific knowledge and technological expertise as myself. And when we're looking at a project on the singularity, I've been lecturing on it for 3 to 5 years. And, I'm featured in Ray's books. But this has nothing to do about me per se. This has to do with women. And it's very important that we include women, as we may not be as famous, quote-unquote, as some of the men that were interviewed for this, but we've been around, and we have a voice, and we are just as knowledgeable.
Yes.
So
well, I don't that was
curious,
disagree.
Curiosity to me.
I actually really do agree with your point, and it's well taken. Again, as I was saying, though, there's just in the field – when we're making the movie, what we're really doing is we're on the road with Ray, following Ray wherever he goes. And so the people that are interviewed in the film, the 80 people, thought leaders, scientists, academics that we interview, are people that we interview that actually kind of Ray runs up against in the course of the 2 years that we're filming the project. And so those are the people that we ended up interviewing. And, 95% of them ended up being men. By no kind of overt plan on my part, that was just these are the people that were in the field at the time or on the stage at the time when we and our cameras came along. Towards the end of the film, as there were less, as we started to realize that there weren't any women in the film near the very end and things were getting tight in time, we started trying to reach out to Sherry Turkle and others. Before we knew
no one called me.
I think
this is an important point because just recently Ray was interviewed for Time Magazine, a feature, and he asked the journalist to contact me for it, but the journalist did not. So I think we need to look at the singularity and these issues as where are the women? Why are not the women having a voice in this? Because the singularity includes all of us. Now, this may be stem from because it's about a man and we're in a man's world. But I don't want to get off on that aspect of it. It was just a curiosity to me. And, that was the only thing that really stood out like a sore thumb in my mind because I am a filmmaker and I am involved in the film industry and especially Hollywood. So I noticed these things very clearly. And because I left that industry to study futurology and I pioneered transhumanism, where the singularity stems out of, vis-a-vis Werner Vinge. And so it's very interesting to me to see how we often go for the most famous names, thinking that those names have all the answers or can give the variety. But the more I'm learning about what really stimulates people when they want to learn about a concept as curious and as frightening as the singularity, they want to have people who are in it and a part of it really speaking about it, not just the theoreticians. And I'm a theoretician, so I'm criticizing my own field. But that's just one comment, and I'll pass the baton to someone else.
Well, I would just jump in and say, point well taken, Natasha. But I think that first off, there are women in the movie. We see people who are personally close to Ray, and I think that one of the things that's interesting about the movie is that we get this kind of insider view of Ray's life. We meet his mother, we meet Ray's wife. The Singularity Is Near, of course, the hero is Ray's alter ego, who's a woman. So I should point out that in real life, whenever I deal with the Kurzweil organization, I'm always dealing with Sarah and Amara. That, you know, he is Ray Kurzweil is a guy who's surrounded by women who play a very important role in the work that he does. But let's shift gears just a little bit. I would like to I want to open a question up here to the panel. And PJ, I'm going to give this one to you, because I know you're a writer and that you deal with fictional stories. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was watching this movie is that I almost felt like I was watching a science fiction story. That 10, 20 years ago, this could have been this could have been a movie about, well, here's this guy who's going to try to usher in this new age for humanity, and now we learn his motivation for doing it. And here's my question: if this were a story you made up, is this the story? If you were going to tell the story about someone trying to usher in this new age for humanity, is this the story that you would tell, or would you tell it differently in some ways if we were making it up?
Well, one of the things I do love about the movie is that he does talk about the motivations that Ray has. You know, the basis of any great character is the motivation, and one could almost say the flaws. You know, what are the Achilles heels, the quirks that drive the character that many people might not be able to agree with, but they can understand why the character does what he does. And I think the issues about his father and his own personal health journey are things that people can relate to, and they can you could spin the story very easily out from that. Of course, in any story, you actually want to see it come to an end. And my question for Barry was going to be, could you ever perceive a sequel? You know, even a joking sequel to the movie, because, of course, you'd want to see what happens when he actually does it, or if he actually does it, meaning recreate his father, become a cyborg, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, that's believe it or not, I mean, I'm flattered by the question, because it usually refers to, I guess, the film being entertaining enough to warrant a sequel. But I think that I'm not a big sequel fan. I mean, there have been a few in history, Godfather or whatnot, that have either equaled or surpassed the first one. But I think that the reason the film works like it does is because, as you pointed out, it does end where it does. And, you know, if you start to, if we start to shed too much light, we start on what would happen, my feeling is that the mystery and some of what you derive entertaining-wise and would start to be kind of washed away. And so although you could certainly make a sequel that would have a great deal of information and data, and it would be just a trove in terms of more advanced courses on singularity, in terms of the human struggle, I think it would be, for me, at least for this filmmaker, it would be hard for me to even know where to dig in and kind of what to do with that, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes complete sense, and by the way, I agree with you. But in terms of fictionalizing the story, you'd want to see at least the attempt made for the eventual goals that the character Ray
right.
is trying to achieve.
Sure.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that's sort of the difference between this movie and The Singularity Is Near, which it kind of takes us it takes us through to those next steps, and that's the difference, I guess, between fiction and a documentary. With a documentary, you have to deal with what has actually occurred to this point. So a certain amount of restraint is required. Barry, you weren't able to show us the singularity. You showed us people talking about it, but through doing that, evoked it, I think, quite powerfully.
I found the same things touching, I think, that you found, Phil. It's explaining the motivations of Ray. I mean, obviously, you know, you start with a brilliant, you know, a genius level kid, okay, growing up in a family with a special father, one who's, you know, well known as a musician, and you know, any sons that have dads that really made their mark in the world have certain issues that they've got to work out in their life. And he loses his father early, and how that motivates him. I think a brilliant take on the story, and I thought it increased the interest that, you know, people that might not normally have a whole lot of interest in singularity type topics would still enjoy this movie. I know my wife really enjoyed it, and she's, you know, less interested in these issues than I am. So I thought it was a good movie, but just as a filmmaker.
You find a powerful human story there. That. Barry, yeah. What you were talking about before, the scene standing at his father's graveside, that is a moving scene. That would be a moving scene were it anyone. But when you put the context of who Ray is and what drives him and what motivates him, it's very effective. Now, I have another question for you, which is I found the movie to be a really good mix of Ray's views and some substantive critical views. Now, this is typical for material dealing with Ray Kurzweil, because in his books he always includes the other side. He even the GNR breakdown, as Stephen and I were talking about this the other day, even that breakdown of GNR doesn't come from Ray. That originates with Bill Joy in his piece on Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. So Ray is very much about looking at the world through the eyes of his critics, looking at the world through the eyes of people who disagree with him, or who would say that no, this is not what's happening. The world is actually moving in a completely different direction.
Right.
Having said all that, you know, with between I would say like some random, he seems to be random. On one end of the credibility scale, or maybe that caller on C-SPAN, that's the very, very far end of one end of the credibility scale, to like Kevin Kelly on the other, who I think raises significant criticisms of Ray's view of the future. It really dealt effectively with those criticisms, and it makes me wonder, which way do you lean? Do you buy into Ray's vision of the future? Do you accept Kevin Kelly's criticisms that maybe it won't all happen as fast as Ray thinks it will? Do you accept Hugo de Garis's argument that it might wind up looking completely different? Where do you sit with all that?
Well, I make no bones about it. I am, you know, a Kurzweilian singularitarian. I advocate for his ideas and the way he's articulating his vision of the singularity. I do believe it to be the correct vision. I think he's aligned himself with universal evolution on a time scale that is very, very powerful to refute. And I think many people, even brilliant people like Kevin Kelly, often, I think, get mired down in certain details and don't look at the universality of how long this has been going on and how we happen to be living at this precise moment right now. And I knew early going, you know, into the film from early time that I had to throw everything I could against Ray. My goal when I found out what I wanted to do with the story, I knew that I had to, once I had set him on his objective and what he was going to do in the story, I then had to thwart him from doing that. I had to take that away from him as many times as I could throughout the film. And that's, of course, what makes great drama. And so even if it's a documentary, it doesn't matter. And so my goal then as a filmmaker was to be as objective as I could. And when I started, I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can find, in the next 2 years or however long I make this movie, if I can find an argument that I feel comfortable about that can actually disprove Ray's theory about the singularity. And so that's what I set out to do. And everyone I would interview, I would try to find out, is there an argument here that I can put up on the screen that would discredit Ray's theories about the singularity? And so that's kind of the impetus of where that came from.
Well, I think it created a really a really powerful dialogue in the movie, and it's very effective just because it shows how seriously the issues are taken. That you get those conflicting perspectives. Who's next, Stephen? Question for Barry.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, you know, towards the end of the movie, we're really pulling for the character Ray, as if he's a character. You know, he's a real person, but I mean, you're really pulling for Ray to make it. You know, Ray, of course, he's not a youngster anymore, and he has a few health issues. He was diagnosed with diabetes. Apparently, he has that pretty well under control, but he also has a heart condition. I guess I should probably open this up to everybody, including you, Barry. He is a truly unique individual. What happens to the transhumanist community when we lose Ray, if we were to lose him? What do you guys think?
May I respond after Barry? This is Natasha.
Yeah.
Natasha, why don't you go ahead and respond before Barry? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, there's a backup plan. There's a number of backup plans, but the most well-known and successful research and investigation has been done on cryonics. Cryonics is a safety net. No one wants to be suspended, but it's the better alternative to cremation or being buried in the ground if you want to continue living, prolongation of life. So cryonics is there. Certainly we don't have a resolve for reanimation, but with nanotechnology and the merging and converging of the nanobioinfocogno and neurosciences and robotics, it's probably likely that we will be able to do that. So this brings one of, I think, the most important elements of the film, which is death and looking at death. And that was my favorite part of the film, which I think Barry did in an exquisite and gentle and loving yet dramatic way, even on the subtlest of emotions, to show that every human being has a time clock continually ticking, and we don't know if we're going to live or die from moment to moment. And then we forget that for a little while, but then it's brought back to us. And this is the albatross around our neck that we each, every one of us, face. Some of us may want death because of our religious or spiritual views. Others of us may not want death. The transhumanist view is, of course, to prolong life and enhance personhood. So in response to the question about the alternatives from the transhumanist perspective, cryonics as a safety net, again, it may not work, but it's the best option we have. The other option is whole brain emulation, which is formerly called the upload. And this whole brain emulation is the transference and copying of the cognitive properties of the brain to a computational format, which becomes from biological to semi-biological to computational. And that would create other environments for us to coexist if we copy ourselves. Then we get into philosophical issues of, are you the same person and all that. But basically, let's take it from the point that we are the same person and we do coexist in a computational system. The computational system that we know right now is the computer, for example. But it doesn't have to be. There could be new types of platforms and substrates to coexist. And we could have multiple selves, multiple identities. So this is how transhumanism deals with death. We are looking at solutions for even changing the definition of death. So you may have partial death rather than exclusionary permanent death. You could be suspended for a while, come out, have optional death, reversible death, et cetera. So that's how transhumanists are looking at the issue of death, which I found to be a very crucial and important and meaningful aspect of this film to touch everyone on some level of death.
For sure, and definitely that's where Ray wants to take it. I think especially the uploading thing. I mean, he wants to live long enough to upload his mind. And I actually don't know. Barry, would you know off the top of your head, is he a participant in cryonics? Is that something?
Yes,
that's...
he is. Yes, he is.
Yeah, he signed up at Al Gore. He kind of went kicking and screaming a little bit. He had resisted for quite some time, but he has signed up at Al Gore. And he does agree that it is the best alternative with the technologies we have. Obviously, you're going to have a lot more information in a frozen chronic state than you would if you were buried in the ground or if you were cremated. So as Natasha pointed out, rightfully so, there's just going to be a lot more information there for us to reverse engineer 20, 25, 30 years from now. So, he finally broke down and joined, I think, last year.
Well, that's interesting. So to Stephen's original question, what do you think, where would the transhumanist community be without Ray if he were to depart from us so temporarily?
I don't get any enjoyment kind of talking about, Ray and the possibility of him passing. It doesn't strikes me as kind of being, I don't know, strange or something, but I'm close with Ray. I know Ray well. But if I was pressed on the subject, I think that actually, believe it or not, his death would actually serve to solidify and galvanize the movement more than anything. His writings would still exist. All the information, the movies would still exist about him. All the information and articles that he's written would still exist. So I think his and this has been the case in many instances throughout history where a prophetic type of figure they pass along and it actually galvanizes a group of people and they actually end up disseminating the information of that person with more conviction. I actually believe that would probably take place. And I hope it does not.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Hey, yeah. PJ, question for Barry.
Oh, golly. Can you go, can someone else ask right now?
Sure. I got a ton. Or anyone else who wants to jump in. But I'm interested in something that Hugo de Garris said in the film. And I want to make sure that I got it right. At one point, he's talking kind of bombastically, and I thought I understood him to say rhetorically. So am I saying that I'm trying to bring about the technology that might bring about the end of humanity? Yes, I am. Is that accurate? Is that what Hugo said? And if so, can you help us understand what he meant by that?
I can reiterate that is in fact what Hugo de Garris said.
Okay.
I cannot go inside his brain and explain exactly what that means from Hugo's perspective. I think what it was was that we had many discussions over the course of several days in Hong Kong back in 2008, and we were going down the proverbial line of questions that you ask when you're talking about the singularity. And I think I got to a point where he was describing this Artemis war and how humans will be fighting humans in this post-apocalyptic type of scenario where there'll be some enhanced and some not enhanced. And so I finally just put the question to him, well, if you're a brain builder yourself, what are you suggesting? Are you suggesting that you are going to be partially responsible for the demise of our civilization? And that's the way he answered.
Yeah, I think I'll just jump in here. This is Natasha. Hugo's ideas about the Artelex, and it's fictional. It's a supposition, but it's a fictional supposition. It's based on your typical film industry Terminator. Robotics, AI, becoming more intelligent than the human and taking over. So he sees that as a real fear, but it's a fictional fear. It's a fear based on a historical. It's a fear based on a historical need to overcome and human competition with the unknown and query about the unknown. There's also the theory about the humanish versus a post-biologicals, or the humans versus the post-biologicals or post-humans. So it's all based in this area of the possibility of computer scientists or cognitive scientists developing AGIs that outsmart humans. But I never subscribe to that, frankly, because my view is that the transhuman will become the post-human to the upload, et cetera, that we're in this perpetual evolutionary process, and that if we are faced as humans, if we are faced with a confrontation that could wipe out our species, for goodness sakes, we're going to become the AI. So I think it's just a matter of how much will we stand for. I don't think that the human species gives in quickly. I think we're real fighters, we're very competitive, and we want our species to stay around for a while. So as far as the Artelex or the post-biologicals being a species that takes over humans, I think that would only happen through our very rigorous fight where we would give up because we have to, but I don't think we will.
Right.
Well, yeah,
I think Natasha's quite correct with her assessment, if I just may say. I think that, first of all, there is the need, and we have this narrative that's been around for a long time, since Frankenstein, really, where science fiction has been a cautionary tale. And if you're going to write a good story, whether it's even if it's you know, partially a documentary like Transcendent Man, or whether it's The Matrix, whether it's what have you, you know, Terminator, you're going to need this antagonizing force. You're going to need to create this dystopian conflict to create conflict, to make the film interesting, to give it tension, to create drama. And so this is what they do. They say, oh, the superior AI is able to grow without humans also growing. But that's not what we see. We see clearly that computers are shrinking in size and price performance. And we can see that what's happened from a computer that took up an entire building to your iPhone today, and where that will be in 25 years, would be the size of a red blood cell. The AIs will be within us. We will be AIs. There will be no us or them. You won't be able to go into a room and divide the AIs from the non, you know, the biologicals from the non, you know, from the AIs. It just won't happen. So, and also, I do believe truly that these AIs will be much more lovely and beautiful and creative than we might think. I think that. You know, for a lot of reasons, for a whole host of them that we can talk for an hour just about that. But I do think they'll be our children in many ways. And like children, look up to their parents. I think that these AIs will have a link through humanity back to their origins. And these AIs are going to be stymied. They're going to have to reach the boundaries of their own understanding of the universe. And they're going to need a link back to whatever we think is the beginning of time, the Big Bang, whatever. And that link is going to go through humanity. And so I think we're going to be very closely linked with these AIs.
I'd also say, this is PJ, I'd also say, frankly, it's always struck me that Hugo grasping on to this very Hollywood tale to tell, which is the Ardalic tale, has always struck me as just being very good copy. It's gotten him a lot of attention. And it's important in the AGI community because AGI is possibly one of the least funded of all artificial intelligence today. We have a lot of funding of narrow AI because we have narrow AI throughout our modern societies. But AGI, artificial general intelligence, is something that we don't fund very well. And Hugo's Hollywood tale-telling has gotten him a great deal of financing.
Yep. He's speaking in images that are familiar and that immediately resonate because
exactly right, because this is a story, as Barry said, it has been told for at least a couple centuries. Well, I would actually posit it's been told for thousands of years.
The
story of a human versus a more than human entity, and what happens when those two entities interact. You can go back all the way back to the Bible. You can go before the Bible. This is an archetype of a story, and often what happens when humans interact with more than human entities that don't have their best interests at heart, you know, bad things happen, and there you have drama. So this is a very, very old story.
Yeah, Icarus. Yeah.
Very true.
Well, I've got a question now from the chat room, so I'm going to spread this one around. Everyone gets to chime in on this one, or I'll give Barry the last word. And I think, Stephen, we'll start with you. What is your thought, Stephen, on the key technology driving the move towards the singularity? What do you think is the prime, if something is moving us towards the singularity, what's the main driver towards it?
Well, it's... We could call it a number of things. You could say Moore's Law, the ability to put more and more computer chips in a smaller and smaller space. Ray put it this way in the movie. He said simply that the mainframe that I was working on back when I was in school, compare that to the iPhone in your pocket. The iPhone is a million times smaller, and it's also a million times more powerful than the mainframe that the whole university was using. And so
which cost billions of dollars versus the iPhone,
right,
which costs $100. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So you put all those factors together, basically you are a billion times you got a billion times more computation per dollar spent than what we could do back when I was, you know, in school. That is the driver. Now, you know, and he also talked about the power of the exponential. You take 30 steps linearly, you've just taken 30 steps. But if you take 30 steps exponentially, Barry, is that a billion? I believe that's right.
Yeah, 25 is a million and 30 is a billion.
Okay, 30 is a billion. So 30 steps exponentially is a billion. And so, you know, so maybe we've taken 30 steps, and it would appear, based on what he just, you know, explained to us, that we've taken 30 steps since his days back in college. What is 30 more steps going to do for us? What, you know, and it's hard to argue with that. You know, I mean, it's as profound as the things that we're talking about here are, and how it would absolutely interrupt human history. How do you argue with what we're seeing happening? And so I think that's the basis for accelerating technology.
Okay, good answer. We'll give the same question over to Natasha. What do you think? What's the major driver towards the singularity?
You know, it's interesting. You think, what drives change? Is it the technology or the human need for change? I'll have to go with the human need. I think that we drive everything. Technology is not alive until we give it breath, until we innovate, create, and give it a life of its own. So I would say that it's the human innate, intrinsic desire to innovate, to use whatever tools we have during whatever time frame we exist, to use those tools to innovate, to bring us closer to one another or to the environment or to communication. So whatever we use, whether it's at Stonehenge, following the sun and the stars, to developing mathematics, to developing literature, to developing telephones to communicate, we want to be almost inside each other and yet around each other at the same time. So I would say the driving force behind accelerating growth and the pending singularity would be based on our almost, it's an intrinsic innate quality, but it's also almost unconscious. Like, we don't know when we're doing it, we're just doing it. So we're driven. And what drives that? It's for me, it's a sense of being in life. When you try to describe what is life, how does it feel to be alive, all we know is that we're alive at this very moment. And it's wonderful to be able to exchange with you all and with Barry and to feel and express and understand one another. So I think that's the driving force.
Driving towards the singularity is just kind of who we are, if you will.
Yeah.
Okay. PJ, what do you think?
Natasha, I loved your answer.
Thank you.
Well, because I just have to be different. I think one of the key concepts in the movie, which I really appreciated seeing articulated on screen, is this notion of information as the basis of the universe. And we have been stewards of information for millennia. We're really finally realizing the depths of which that information goes. It goes down to our very cellular level. It goes down to our molecular level. It goes down to the molecular level of all the things around us. And it's that recognition that the universe is information that is going to make the biggest changes happen the fastest.
That makes sense. You know, I would actually, I would combine, PJ, I would combine your answers and Natasha's, because I think it's both of those things. Absolutely, that is the nature of information and what's occurring with information, and it's our nature because that's what we are. Ultimately, that's what humanity is. We are this, among other things, this vast, complex aggregation of information. But now we can turn it over to Barry, and he can give us the definitive answer. Barry, what do you think is is driving us towards the singularity?
Come on, Barry.
Well, I have to say, I really enjoyed those answers, and they all are so accurate from different points of view, and you couldn't have, I think, a clear vision without any of those points being brought up. I will say, Natasha touched on this, and PJ, you did too, that what is the most powerful force in the universe? And, you know, Ray mentions it in the movie, and it's intelligence. And for whatever reason that we don't, physicists don't know yet, we happen to live in this universe where the conditions were just right, that information could be encoded in the structure itself. And we've seen this grow in complexity in these patterns of information of increasing order since all the way back to the Big Bang. And so for whatever reason, we happen to, and this has been going along for a long time. First we had atoms, and then the furnace of stars. We had, you know, molecules and then organic molecules. And then, we had the Cambrian explosion. And then we had brains were able to evolve. We had information encoded in brains. And then the brains created technology. And we have now information encoded in technology. But it's always been about creating information and patterns of information of increasing order and complexity. And so for whatever reason, we happen now to all exist at this precise moment when the complexity is becoming so great that actually it amplifies who we are so greatly that it just kind of becomes mind-boggling at what we get to do with it. And so we always talk about what is technology. I mean, what does it mean to be a human? And technology amplifies what it means to be human. And it always has since the beginning when we first picked up that first stick. It's always amplified either for good or for bad, because technology is a double-edged sword. But we primarily use technology for good. I mean, if we weren't, we wouldn't be on this phone call right now talking to each other. We'd all have destroyed ourselves long ago. But no, we use technology for good. We use the fire to heat our food and to warm ourselves and not to burn down our neighbor's house. So, but Natasha was, you know, getting onto a point there where she was almost having problems articulating it. And I know what she means. It's like we're alive now, and it's almost like this destiny. We're moving towards another epic where we're going to express ourselves in ways that we can't yet fathom, but it's more complex, and it's more beautiful, and it's more creative, and it's more human. And that's what Natasha is talking about when she uses the word transhumanism. It's to become more human, to become uberhuman, to become superhuman, whatever phrase you want to throw at it. That is what I think where we're going, and that's, you know, at least that's my point of view.
Well, I love that answer, but it leads me to my question, Barry. I appreciate that you threw in all sorts of competing viewpoints, and you had a couple of Christians who gave their viewpoints. One of them was the radio host Chuck Missler, I believe.
Right.
He basically said there's a danger to worshiping technology, taking ourselves too seriously. I thought that was well placed at that point. What dangers are there if you agree with that or not? Looking forward, I mean, is there a danger of
I put that in there for obvious reasons. Again, I'm trying to create conflict and trying to get other viewpoints in there. But, I mean, we are a self-reflective species, and thank goodness we are so. I mean, thank goodness we have looked at ourselves so carefully and under a microscope for so many centuries, and we've written poetry and books. And, again, and by the way, we talk about technology as just being cutting-edge technology. Facebook is a technology, or your iPhone is a technology, but the truth of the matter is that technologies have been around for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, animal husbandry is a technology, or agriculture, or a Shakespeare poem, or when, you know, for heaven's sake, when Michael Jordan is slam dunking a basketball, that's a technology that's allowing us to kind of go beyond and transcend our limitations. So this is something that's been happening, and we've been trying to look at for a long time. You know, I use the Shakespeare poem analogy, and Shakespeare said, "Art is this mirror we put up to nature." And if that's true, and I believe it is, today the most cutting edge technology is filmmaking. We have these films, and we have these thousands and tens of thousands and millions of screens all around the world that allow us to self reflect. And I think that that's a very, very powerful thing for us to do, and it's a necessary thing. I don't think we could have our civilization as advanced as it is today without that. Without the ability to be informed by our art. And so I'm very proud of our species, and I'm glad that we're self-reflective, and I'm glad that we put attention on our technology, which is really an extension of who we are. And so obviously I put that, you know, I put his comment in there, but I very much disagree with it at heart.
Okay. Barry, I love that statement that you're proud of humanity. I am too, and I feel like that doesn't get said very often, that there's a we're supposed to feel bad about
so much, and there's a lot, you know, that definitely we could feel bad about, but I think there's an awful lot to feel good about too. And
what a work is man, you know. I was just quoting Shakespeare, what a work is man, how noble are his faculties. I mean, we are an amazing species at an amazing time. There are a lot of problems. We have a lot of challenges around the world. But look what happens when we use technology and when we have a front row seat to these challenges around the world, whether it's on the TV or on the computer. What do? We're very, very, very good about trying to go and solve those problems, whether it's an oil spill in the Gulf or whether it's, you know, some miners trapped in the mine somewhere. We immediately have to go solve those problems, and we do a really good job at it, and we need to understand that for a moment. Yes, the world, things aren't always getting worse and worse. They're actually getting better and better, but we just keep always introducing these challenges into our living rooms faster and faster and faster so that we can overcome these challenges. And that's, I think, I believe, a more accurate way of looking at what's happening in the world today.
Okay, I have to step in at this point and say we're actually at the point where I would have to have Stephen cue the concluding music because we're about 5 minutes out. We actually asked for a bit additional time, and Barry, if you have a few more minutes, we'd like to continue talking maybe for an additional 15-minute segment.
Sure.
That'd be great. Panelists, are you with us?
Absolutely.
I'll go.
All right. Great. We're going to push on just a little bit then because we're having too much.
2 minutes and counting.
Fantastic. Okay. We have another question actually from the chat room, and I need to scroll back and find it because this was a good one. This is actually a follow-up question to the one we had earlier. We talked earlier about what are the major drivers that are taking us to the singularity, and here's another take on the same process. What are some of the possible negative effects as we move closer to the singularity? And PJ, I'll let you take that one first.
Well, just about every Hollywood and literary scenario you can think of, including Hugo's. Technology has always been a double-edged sword. The same, you know, the plowshare into swords, if you will. The stick can be used to furrow the ground or hit someone over the head. I firmly believe that the singularity is the moment where we will no longer have the option of control. Because of that, we have to be extremely careful of all the possible scenarios. You know, we had this show just a couple of weeks ago with you of all the negative scenarios and how frustrating that can be for people who want to think well of the future, but
right.
Unless we assess all these negative scenarios, and there are too many to count, unless we can start anticipating them and heading them off at the pass, there is the possibility that any one of them could be a great existential risk. And the singularity is the ultimate existential risk. So I'm up for talking about the dangers of AGI. I'm up for talking about the dangers of any kind of AGI, be it environmental, be it population, be it technological and weaponry, any kind of effect that AGI could have on any system that allows us to continue to survive.
Absolutely. Okay. Stephen, what do you think?
Well, that's absolutely a big part of it. I agree with part of what the radio host Chuck Missler was saying. I think that there is a danger of us getting not thinking, you know, being too excited about technology without thinking of the downside. I think that the perfect combination is to kind of mix Bill Joy and Ray Kurzweil together. Be aware of the negative downsides that there could be, and as PJ said, try to hit them off, you know. But there's no stopping it, though. I mean, you know, how are we going to put the genie back in the bottle? It can't be done. So basically, I guess, you know, if I had to argue for something, I'd say, you know, put the accelerator to the floor in an effort to develop the defenses to these various technologies. At the same time, we're developing the technologies. So,
I agree, and I think getting back to our PJ, thanks for mentioning the show from a couple of weeks ago, because one of the things we talked about was the risk related to unfriendly artificial intelligence. If a non-human sympathetic artificial intelligence were to come online, the risk that that represents to humanity. I think if I were going to pick one thing that is kind of the end game, the kind of game over scenario, that's the one that I think we need to be completely concerned about. That's one that we really have to be on the lookout for. Because Stephen, to your point, it's inevitable that we're going to get to a new level of intelligence, a new substrate for intelligence. The question is, who is that intelligence going to be? What's it going to be, and how is it going to be disposed towards us? And that's a formulation that it seems to me we absolutely have to get right. Natasha, what do you think?
Okay. I think for me, for my suggestion of what could be the worst possible scenario, or I think that was your question. I was so involved in the different answers, I may have misinterpreted. But if that,
no, that's it.
Okay, it would be a lack of critical thinking, and let me bookcase that with saying that critical thinking, such as that the singularity is going to happen in one fall swoop, that it's going to happen overnight, right, like that. That's just one supposition for the singularity. I tend to look at the singularity as happening in surges, ups and downs. We'll keep on moving up and a little bit down, and a little bit up, a little bit down, and maybe big up, a little bit down, but not overnight. I don't think that's possible. So I see it as the singularity in surges until we interface with superintelligence. I don't think we'll lose our control, as PJ suggests, as much as I adore PJ. I don't agree with that, because I think we will become the superintelligences. Certainly there'll be some negative characters just like there are today, and psychology will become a new field with a tremendous amount of new theory and research and development. So psychology will become very big in that area. The other thing is existential risk. I think that's a very poor term, a phrase that a philosopher embarked on, and it's spread like mimetic engineering within the futurist community. I think a better and more appropriate phrase would be human extinction risk. Existential risk deals with more, you think of existentialism and Sartre and Nietzsche, et cetera, but it's human extinction risk that we have to think about. That's why our survival and our sustainability is crucial. And the last point here is that I think this is all under the umbrella of critical thinking, which ties in PJ's comments and which ties in Stephen's comments. But even within that, one of the most important areas for us to deal with and learn about is diversity. We must become more diverse and more acceptance of our own diversity and unique characteristics and qualities, because as we become the AGI and the superintelligence and merge more seamlessly with technology, computers, we are going to become more diversified, not homogenous, as a lot of people seem to assume, that we'll become like, you know, everyone else. So I think that within the critical thinking umbrella, that diversity stands out there as a psychology that's so important and so needed, and if we don't accept diversity amongst ourselves and each other, then we could be the doomed art elect or humanist versus post-biological scenarios.
Okay, well, I love that distinction. I love that. I've not heard that critique of the term existential risk before. When you look at it in those terms, the ultimate existential risk would be flunking that philosophy 101 class, right? That's the
yeah.
Biggest existential risk we could face. Okay, Barry, what do you? Once again, you get to give the definitive answer to the question. What's the big risk here?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, first of all, you know, we were talking about existentialist risks or human extinction risks, without actually revealing what we all happen to know, which is that there's been this sort of Damocles that's been hanging over our heads now for the last 50 or 60 years. We've already had a risk, you know, 20,000 nuclear weapons on the hair trigger has been something of a risk. And I think that, you know, this that we are we have today with those weapons could be as bad as it gets. I mean, I think that there's three really human extinction, if I can use Natasha's term, scenarios. One is a thermonuclear war. The second is a pandemic of some sort. And the third is if a rogue asteroid were to hit the Earth. And until we're able to clone or get off our planet and go interplanetary to another planet, we will have that risk will be around. But I said earlier I have a lot of faith in our species. I mean, I could put it in another way. I have a lot of faith in the universe that we happen to inhabit. I mean, I look at the big picture and I see this universe that continuously reveals itself in more complex and in patterns of increasing order. And these patterns of increasing order, which can be anything from a piece of music, a symphony, to a poem or a TV show or a movie or this conversation right now, they're becoming more beautiful and more creative. And I don't think that's going to stop. And I think that we're going to, we're going to become connected. We already are. We're already becoming connected with countries in a way. I mean, we do more commerce over the internet than many countries in the world today. And as we become more interconnected, the threshold for going to war is going to start to diminish. And also, as we start to climb up, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the threshold. I mean, for example, you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you talk about kids in Africa. There's kids in Africa today with a smartphone or access to the internet that have access to more information than our U.S. president did just 15 years ago. And that's something we need to stop and think about for a moment when we're talking about moving forward and how things are going to change really quickly in places like Africa and the third world. So you take some of these people with vertical integration of how we're going to be getting energy sources and how we're going to be providing food and how things are going to change everywhere and become decentralized and how these technologies are democratizing, and you start to see that, listen, you take people and you give them 3 square meals a day and a roof over their heads, and the threshold for going to war and creating violent acts is going to diminish greatly. And I actually believe that we're only 25 years or so away from not just the Western world or the people that are within earshot of this conversation right now, but the entire planet being able to participate in being creative and self-actualization. So it's in my DNA. I'm an optimist. I believe I have a lot of faith in this universe we live in to reveal itself in more beautiful and creative ways. And I think that's not going to stop. It's only going to grow exponentially. And we happen to live at this amazing moment when we get to bear witness to it.
All right. Well, I've got a couple of more questions, but I just want to, before I use up the rest of our time, I'll just open it up to anyone on the panel who has an additional question for Barry.
I'm good.
Well, actually, I want to go back and I want to address one of my own questions earlier because I didn't get to give my own response, which the question was distinguishing this film, Transcendent Man, which is a documentary and it tells a true story, from how this might be altered somewhat if it were a made up story. There's two big differences that I see. If I were going to make this story up, the guy wouldn't be he wouldn't be concerned about his dad. It would have been like his lost love, right? If it were a fictional story, that's what it would be, right?
Sex and
it,
drama.
It would have been his girlfriend from college or something like that, right? That would be more. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that movie's been made. It's on the tip of my tongue what movie that is. The guy who wants to bring about the end of the world because he lost his girlfriend. But the other thing is, if this were a fiction movie, Ray would not be the star. Does anyone know who I think would be the star of this movie based on my viewing of it? Anyone care to guess? Steven, you might have an idea who I think.
Barry, do you have a guess?
Woody Allen? I mean,
No. He's in the movie.
That was a joke.
The actual star is in the movie.
Don't say Charlie Sheen, please.
Somebody in the movie, and not William Shatner either. I was going to say, if this was a Hollywood movie, right, the star would be Ben Goertzel for sure, right?
we love Ben.
We love Ben. And man, does he chew up the screen or what? This guy is just—he is a rock star. And I think he's used to very good effect. Actually, Stephen, you had quoted him on a tweet about some review where he got even higher praise than I just gave him. I can't remember what the phrase was. Do you remember what it was off the top of your head? It was something along the lines of Rockstar from Mars, but I think it was even better than that. I can't remember. Do you remember?
Well, Rockstar from Mars sounds like something Charlie Sheen said. I think. But no, it was very much like that. I mean, he is a compelling character, and he was used well in this movie.
Yeah, I would say, Barry, you know, don't worry about doing a sequel. But if you want to do another movie in the same vein, do a movie about Ben. I could easily watch that. Watch a movie about Ben.
Ben's an entertaining figure. He's a hell of a smart guy. But he also happens to have a certain charm to him, he's like you say, he's just interesting to look at.
Yeah.
And yeah. I've actually seen reviews where they say he stole the movie. So
yeah.
Well, I think his hat stole the movie. His hat stole the movie at one thing.
Yeah.
He was great.
It's a great hat. That he rocks that hat even when he's on Fast Forward Radio. That's the amazing thing, and it still takes over. That's the beauty of that hat. Okay, so I've got one more question. This is a question for the panel. So I'm gonna let this go around, and I don't want to hear any "it depends." Okay, this is a yes or no question, and I need a defense of your answer. And Barry will give us the definitive answer at the end. Okay, so and I'll start with Stephen. Stephen, the question is: will Ray Kurzweil one day bring his father back to life?
It depends. You know what? I'm glad you brought that up. That is, I think it's a big deal in the movie because it's probably the most hard to believe thing that Ray holds dear to himself. Okay. A lot of very rational people get off the boat right before, they make the last stop there with Ray, that I'm going to bring my dad back, okay?
Right.
If we get all the technology that Ray's talking about, what we end up getting is an AI that thinks it's his dad, that has all that information uploaded in it and is very convincing as his dad. But does that equal his father?
Okay. I'm
going to come
yes
down.
No,
you're looking for a yes or no. I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
That's not as bad. And anyway, I'll leave it at that. Somebody else can take the other side of that argument.
Okay, Natasha, what do you think?
Well, I just can't take the other side of that argument. I mean, we're getting into one of the deepest and boldest philosophical issues of continuity, and so the. Perpetual question. It's the persistence question in philosophy, which I don't know very much about at all, but I would say he would innovate a facsimile of his father, who would think that he is the father. So in all sense and purposes, it would be his father.
So that's a yes?
I have a quantifier there. He would bring back a facsimile of his father who would think he's the father and develop a relationship with Ray, and where Ray accepts him as the father. In essence, he is the father, he is not the father, but for all practical purposes, he is the father. So I can't be yes or no on this. I'm so sorry, and I know that you said we had to be yes or no.
Natasha, you leave me. This breaks my heart, but I have to disqualify your answer because it depends. Your answer has been disqualified. PJ, I need a yes or no answer on this question. Will Ray Kurzweil bring his father back to life?
No. He won't bring his father back to life, but he will bring something into being.
He's being disqualified, too, if I am.
No. What I'm saying is the thing he's bringing into being is something that he is willing to accept as his father. Would you believe it's his father? Would I believe it's his father? No. But he is willing to accept it as his father. I would also say, I'm a big proponent, there's nothing to propone, but I'm fascinated by the notion of whole brain emulation, uploading, et cetera. I don't believe what Ray has in that storage room equals his father.
Okay.
I believe what exists within the neural network of his late father's brain was his father. I do not believe the paperwork equals his father. What he would create would be a fascinating AGI, potentially, and he may train it to be like his father, but I'm going to draw the line and say no.
Okay. All right. Well, before we go to Barry, who will give us the definitive answer to the question, I'm going to pre-disqualify my answer because I think it depends entirely on what you mean by his father. But to me, the closest parallel I can come to is John Smart often talks about this. As you gather more and more information about the people who are still with us in the future, you have a like a scrapbook of your mother that delivers your mother.
So good.
That's like an 80%, you know, delivers about 80% of the experience of actually knowing who she is. And it seems to me that that's very similar to what Ray is talking about. So if to you subjectively that's your parent, okay, great. But from the subjective standpoint of the person who's not with us anymore, it seems to me that it's no longer that person. So I've disqualified myself by saying it depends. Barry, need a yes or no answer from you on this.
All right, I'll give the most controversial answer then because I believe, yes, that it will happen. We could argue for days about the philosophical implications of what that means and what does consciousness mean, and we could go on and on and on. But suffice to say, we are already doing that. And I heard someone moan from the crowd just a moment ago. But if you go online to Facebook today and you were to look up, let's say, someone like Michael Jackson who had passed, you would see what is happening already is the culmination of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people, of bringing together information in a repository, one place, where an AI will start to fabricate a person. You take that information, which is what Ray's talking about when he has this storage facility. You take actually DNA from his father, so you actually bring back genetically his father in that way. You start to bring back information from that person's brain. You bring back information not just from that person's brain, but from all the brains that knew that person that are still alive. And this, we have to understand, we're talking about AIs that are billions and going to be billions of times more intelligent than we are today. Their ability to continue, I mean, it'll be an evolving person, of course, but so is the person who lives today. If, you know, like Ray often says, if his father was still alive today, he'd be a completely different person than the father that died 40 years ago.
Right.
So we could get into this philosophical argument for a long, long time, and we'd also have to qualify what is consciousness. My actually definition of consciousness has changed a lot since I've even made this movie. We have this arrogance; we believe that we're conscious at all. I just happen to be more of a deterministic type of individual from a philosophical point of view nowadays, and I just don't see us as having that much. As much input into the world as we think we do, basically. I'll just leave it at that. But I do think, yes, that we'll bring back people that are important. We already are. Albert Einstein's on Facebook today in a very, very, very nascent form. I think that will grow and evolve over time.
Okay. All right. Well, so we got a yes from you on that. Two very interesting comments in our chat room. One is from Sally. The only way you could recreate Ray's father is by going back in time and recording a significant amount of brain activity, preferably years' worth. And then DC says it may well come down to some kind of partial time travel. We really can't know from our current vantage point. And I think that last statement is key. We're talking about what is possible and what is viewed as possible from a pre-singularity standpoint.
Yeah.
What is possible post-singularity? How can we begin to address that question? We don't know.
Right. That's right. How do we know that wormholes don't exist and we can't? Are we getting pretty exotic? But I mean, how do we know that we can't go back and retrieve information in really discrete ways? You know, how do we know that we? I mean, there's just so many things we could just go on and on about.
Well, universe issue. We don't know. And
right.
I think that
yeah.
Barry, you nailed it on the head with building on that. The comment from the listener. We don't know.
Yeah. absolutely.
So I'm disqualified. That means everyone's disqualified if you do grief.
No,
I want my revenge because I'm disqualified.
Sasha, to be clear, you and I were disqualified. Everyone else gave appropriate.
So two no's, one yes, and two disqualified.
Yeah.
So you know. Well, listen. I know we're well past our time. Barry, quick question for you. You had talked about upcoming release of the film on DVD. Now, where is it currently? It's available on iTunes. Can people be looking for it in their local cinemas? Is it going to be in wider release, or what's the status of that?
So yes, we're on iTunes currently. If you're in the U.S. Or Canada, you can go to iTunes and you can download or rent the movie or buy the movie from iTunes. You can also, if you have cable, you can rent the movie on demand. So you can go to your movies on demand section on your cable box, and you can just rent the movie for 24 hours wherever you are in the country. Come May 24th, movie will be in Blockbusters and in Best Buys and in different retail stores across the country. It already is in Canada, but in the U.S. on May 24th, it will be available, you know, pretty ubiquitously. You should be able to pick it up at your corner Blockbuster. In terms of theatrically, we are currently taking the film on kind of a tour where Ray and I speak alongside the film. We're in Washington, D.C. today. Tomorrow we'll actually be screening the film here in D.C. So there is interest in expanding theatrically the release. We'll see if that materializes. There's a lot of interest, and I'm certainly for it, but we'll have to see if that happens.
Well, I would just say I think there's an enormous audience for it. I think that it would be terrific if that were to happen, and I certainly hope that it does. For everyone listening, if you've not seen this film yet, I give this movie the highest possible recommendation. I recommend everyone listening to this go to iTunes or go to your local pay-per-view provider on cable and please watch Transcendent Man. It is an outstanding film. It encapsulates so much of what we talk about at The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, and it is a beautiful and moving experience watching this movie. And Barry, I thank you for making such a wonderful movie, and I thank you for spending time with us this evening.
Well, again, the pleasure's all mine. I really want to thank you guys for having me, and for PJ and for Natasha for their really insightful and thoughtful questions and answers.
Thanks.
All right. Well, and my thanks to the panel as well. It's great to have all of you on. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The music comes from Modern Science. Just like last week, we're kind of working our way through their latest EP. But wanted to kind of throw it out to the panel as to which song we play tonight, considering what Hugo de Garis is working on. The song could either be Someday from Modern Science or This Is How the World Ends by Modern Science. So y'all let me know, which one would you like to hear tonight?
Okay, so votes, please. It's Someday or This Is How the World Ends. I'll vote for Someday. That sounds like my kind of song. PJ, what do you think?
Someday.
Tasha?
Definitely Someday.
Okay. Barry?
As if you have to ask, it's Someday.
Even, I think it's unanimous.
Guess what?
I vote for Someday as well.
I was going to say, you still have control of the button. You can play either one, but I think the votes are in. So it sounds like we're going to be hearing Someday.
Someday from Modern Science. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Thank
Modern
you.
Science, Someday. Thanks to Barry and to our panel. I appreciate having all of you on. Thanks very much to all our guests in the chat room. Wonderful chat that was going on tonight. Everyone listening live and everyone listening via recording, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back on Saturday with the next installment of The World Transformed 1.5. We'll have another archive show on Monday, and 1 week from tonight we'll be on with Alvis Bridges talking about the future of Facebook. Look forward to having you with us on all of those upcoming shows, and until next time, live to see it. Oh.